For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. Okay, we've had a long summer break since our last class. Let me fill you in as to what we've done and what we will do. There are three different episodes that the Torah describes between Yaakov and Esav. Three different stories that the Torah relates to us as to how these two brothers related to each other. The first episode was their birth, the pregnancy that their mother Rivka has, in which the two boys are already fighting in utero. And during that first episode, the Torah then describes their birth, how Esav came out first, how Yaakov was holding on to his heel, how the two boys grew up. Esav comes in from the field one day famished, and Yaakov sells or buys from him the birthright for the bowl of lentils. That's episode number one in terms of their birth and then the selling of the birthright. We did that a long time ago already. We did it in depth. We did it verse by verse. We did it with the commentary of Rashi, of Ramban. We did it with Rav Hirsch. That was episode number one. Episode number two is upon the death of their father, Yitzchak. Yitzchak decides he wants to bless the two boys. He calls in his eldest son, Esav, and says, go out to the fields, hunt for me some fresh game the way that I love it, prepare me a nice meal, and then I will bless you before I die. Rivka, his wife, overhears this conversation, says to her younger son Yaakov, you need to go out into my flock, take for me the two goats, let me slaughter them, prepare the food the way your father likes. She dresses him up. We noted when we went through this, she's a very passive player in this whole episode, Yaakov. She dresses him, she places the food in his hands, he goes in and has the whole conversation. Yitzchak, his father, says to him, who are you? He says, it is Esav, your firstborn. He gets the, how did this happen so fast? He says, God has allowed me to, you know, find the food so fast. He says, your voice is the voice of Yaakov, but the hands are the hands of Esav. That whole episode, he gives Yaakov the blessing. 2 minutes later, Yaakov exits stage left, stage right, comes in Esav, finds out what happens in that his father says, who are you? I already gave the blessings. And he says, Yaakov, that Yaakov, he's now snuck this thing past me twice. First he stole the birthright from me. Then he stole the blessings from me. That's why they call his name Yaakov. And he cries and he begs his father for a blessing. Don't you have anything left for me? His father at first demurs, and then finally says, okay, I have one thing for you, and basically says, if your brother ever lifts the yoke off of his shoulders, then you'll have the ability to pounce upon him. And then that episode ends with Esa saying, I'm just going to wait till my father dies, then I'm going to kill my younger brother, and Yaakov is instead sent to live with his uncle Lavan. That was episode number two. We are at the very end of that. We've been through that verse by verse. What we're going to start with is the commentary of Rav Hirsch. We did not do that at the end of the beginning of the summer, whatever it was. I want to call it last year. It was just 2 months ago. But that's where we got up to. So we're going to finish that episode.
It was just a new year.
It feels like a new year. It was last year.
That's
correct. It was indeed last year. It was indeed. So last year, that's where we got up to. Rav Hirsch, we don't need all the detailed commentary of Rashi and the Ramban to understand the way Rav Hirsch is going to approach us. He has a very novel. He does not mince words. You will find it to be fascinating, I'm sure, as we go through Rav Hirsch. Just let me just take 2 more minutes to summarize the third episode, which is really what we're going to focus on this year. After we finish Rav Hirsch, this will take us just 2 or 3 weeks, 4 maybe. The third episode is then after Yaakov comes back. He's been banished to his uncle Lavan's house because his brother Esav wants to kill him for swindling out the blessings. He stays there for some 20 years. He comes back to the land of Israel now with 4 wives and 11 children. And on the way back, Esav comes out to meet him. And they have their clash. That's the parsha known as Vayishlach, where Yaakov sends messengers or angels to greet Esav, and he sends all of these lavish gifts so that Esav shouldn't try to kill him. And Esav keeps, and finally they meet, and Yaakov bows down, and Esav says, what's with all these gifts? And he says, it's divine favor. And Esav says, let's walk together. And Yaakov says, you go on up ahead, I have all these young kids and the young flock, I'm going to stay with them, I'll meet you there. and they part ways. Esav goes to Har Seir, and Yaakov goes to the land of Israel. That's a shorthand version of the third episode, is when Yaakov comes back. That's really what we're going to focus on. We'll see that that really is going to have all of the clues as to how Yaakov, us, deals with Esav, which is the Western civilization, Rome, and all of its subsidiaries, is all encompassed in that third episode. How do we handle the exile? How do we get out of the exile? What's the last stage of the exile like? Is encompassed in that third episode of Yaakov's return. But before we get to that, we're just going to finish up this last little bit, which is episode number 2, which is the episode of the stealing of the blessings, which began with Yitzchak on his deathbed, basically saying to his older son Esav, I'm about to die, go to the fields, hunt for me game, feed me, I will then bless you before I die. Yaakov is sent by his mother to do the same, and then he basically steals the blessings, fools his father into giving him the blessings. That's what we're going to do now. We're going to finish with Rav Hirsch, which you have photocopies in front of you. Rav Hirsch, for those of you who have not had the experience with him before, is a very, very poetic writer. He wrote originally, of course, in German. What we have is a translation, and the translation that we're using, which is the first, they've since put out a second translation. This translation is very literal to the words of Rav Hirsch, and as is the original German, many sentences last 6, 7, 8, 9 lines per sentence. There are many, many thoughts in each sentence, and we'll read it as best we can. We'll stop, we'll translate from his language into our language. And go through it. It's a beautiful approach. What he's going to explain in this episode, as I said, he does not mince words.
But and he doesn't die for over 20 years.
Yitzchak will die later. And so he says, I don't know the day of my death, let me bless you. So he's not physically on his deathbed, but he's at the point which Rashi commented, within 5 years of the death of his father, which he already felt it was time for me to tidy up my business because I don't know how much longer I will have. Okay, we're going to be on page 441. The writing of Rav Hirsch, the photocopies that you have are taken from a Chumash. So the Chumash was printed going from right to left, which means even though we're going to be reading the bottom half of the pages, which are in English, it's going to feel a little bit backwards. We're going to start on the left-hand side of the page, which is 441, and you'll note that we're going to have to flip the page because that's, you know, it's really, it's a Hebrew book with English on the bottom. So do not be confused that 440 is on your right and 441 is on your left. We're going to start with 441, beginning of chapter 27. Says Rav Hirsch, as repeatedly remarked, we follow the opinion of our sages and do not consider it our task to be apologists for our great men and women. Meaning to say, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, our forefathers, our foremothers, they are great leaders of the Jewish people. And as if he says, if our sages point out their errors, we do not need to be apologists and say they didn't make an error. We on our own can't say they made errors, but if our sages have said this was not right, or this was not exactly the way that it should have been done, then it's not our job to say, no, it can't be. We follow the cue of our sages and not our task to be apologists for our great men and women, just as the Word of God, the Torah itself, never refrains from informing us of their errors and weaknesses. Rav Hirsch is pointing out something which you find when you go through Sefer Bereishis. Sefer Bereishis is a book which is to teach us how to live. It does not do so by painting an ideal of people who never err, people who never make mistakes, of human beings who are really angels. It is a story, it is a book filled with the errors of human beings for us to learn from. The Torah points it out, the sages point it out. Says Rav Hirsch, therefore I do not need to be an apologist if I'm going to point it out, because I'm simply following the path that the Torah has set forth as has been followed by the sage. If Rivka brought it about that her son Yaakov deceived his fathers, it says quite unequivocally, Bo achircha b'mirma. That's the Hebrew phrase. This was quoted, this when Yitzchak, the father, when he's speaking to his older son Esav. And Esav says to him, Dad, what happened? You were about to bless me. Give me a blessing. And his father says, I don't have it anymore. Your brother came with cunning and took it from you. If that's the words that Yitzchak uses to his older son Esav, your brother came with deception, with cunning. So then, says Rav Hirsch, That's what Rivka brought about. Rivka, the mother, said to her son, do that. And Yaakov did. So I don't need to be apologetic. Something happened here that was b'mirma, that was somehow with cunning, with deception. Reb Chanina expresses himself, Reb Chanina, one of the sages of the Talmud, expresses himself about the events recorded in this chapter as follows. Kol mi she'oimer HaKadosh Baruch Hu vatron hu, anybody who says that God Himself is not so particular with His pious ones, meaning that from people need not be so particular in certain directions, if you can say that Hashem overlooks the righteous and says, ah, Yaakov did this or that, and he deceived his brother, but God overlooks it, says Rabbi Chanin in the Medrash, someone who says that about God, that He's willing to overlook small little things from the righteous, Yusrun Me'av deserves to have his own innards torn out. And where do we see that, he continues? Elama'arech ruchei ve'govedilei, he will be patient and be from repaying in kindness that which was done. Zaka achas hizik Yaakov avinu le'esav, because our forefather Yaakov caused one scream to come out from his brother Esav. Amosai Nifralo, and when was that repaid from Yaakov for causing his brother Esav to scream? Beshushan Habira, in Shushan, in our Purim story, where the Megillah records, Vayizak Zako Gidolo Mara. If you noted when we went through the verses, we noted that the language that the Torah uses for Esav, when he found out what his brother did, Vayizak Zako Gidolo, he cried out a great and bitter cry, almost the exact same language as the Megillah uses about the Jews when they find out about the decree of Haman and Ahasuerus. And the Medrash noted that that's the same language, and that it was indeed in payment for the fact that Yaakov caused his brother Esav to cry that bitter cry, there would be a bitter payment to the children of Yaakov indeed, and Hashem was patient in meeting it out, but it came. And it came in the time of the Megillah story, when the Jewish people would also cry a bitter cry for that which was done. The Medrash connects it to that which Yaakov did to Esav. So again, what's the first pointing out? The Medrash doesn't see in this all, everything is rosy, everything is perfect, because Yaakov causes Esav to cry. And when Yaakov causes Esav to cry, that will bite the Jewish people. There's no way around that. You cause someone else pain, it's going to bite you. The way the world is set up, and the Medrash points it out, the descendants of Yaakov would feel that. They would feel it in the time of Ahasuerus and Shushan, Vayizak, Zako, Gedolo, Mara. They were in the streets crying a bitter cry. Continues, refers, Gimel Demalus, three tiers. It's right in the middle. There's a missing period where he's going to start from, right after, about four lines down from where I stopped reading. Gimel Demalus, in Hebrew, there are three tiers, it says, in the Tanchum. Another Medrash says, Horud Esava, Yasef cried three tears. Achas miyamino, one dropped out of his right eye. Achas nismolo, one came from his left eye. Va'achas nistalko b'seich eino, one, the third tear he kept back. V'hi ha'achilosom lechem dimo, that one, that third tear, the bitterest that he did not drop, says the Medrash, salted our bread of exile with tears, and made us taste tears in full threefold measure. So the Medrash first quotes two different Midrashim where the sages connect the pain of the Jewish exile, whether it be in the Purim story, or just the general sense of the long bitter exile in which we eat our bread soaked and saturated with the salty tears coming from our eyes, is connected to the tears and the cries that Yaakov caused in Esav. So that whether or not Yaakov needed to do this, or Rivka was right in sending him to do this, what we do find is for sure clear, Yaakov did something that was underhanded, that pulled the rug out from underneath Esav. Esav cries, Esav calls out, and there's a payment of retribution that's going to happen because of that. That's the fact, that's the response. However, continues Refersh, but if quiet, thoughtful considerations of this event force one to conclusions that would remove a great deal of its bitterness. Meanwhile, but if we can look at it and study it and come to a conclusion that says, but you know what? It wasn't all that bad. There was reasons why Rivka and Yaakov had to do this. And then as we contemplate and understand this, we remove in his language a little bit of its bitterness. We don't look at it as simply Yaakov was simply just doing all bad, conniving and underhandedly getting these blessings. No, there was reasons. There was a positive to it. So then we do not think we should refrain from giving them in order to avoid our appearing as apologists. Meaning, what's he say? In as much as I'm not an apologist, if the sages say that there was something wrong, we're going to deal with it. I'm also at the same time going to look for the honest truth as to what happened, not to be apologetic, but to say this is what it is. And the truth has its elements of this is why it was done. And the truth has its elements of, and it was possibly wrong, and there were elements of wrong. So he's saying, I'm not going to be an apologist on any side. I'm not going to be an apologist to say nothing was done incorrectly, because the sages say we paid a price for this event. But I'm also not going to be an apologist and say, well, I don't want to make it look like a defense or an excuse. No, there were good reasons why it was done, and I'm going to explain those, and I'm going to explain why it might not have been so good. Enough will still remain which cannot be approved of. Even when I finish explaining it and I tell you why what Yaakov did was right and why what Rivka did was right, there'll still be enough there to explain why the sages saw in this something that was not correct, especially when measured with the yardstick of character of a nation whose name of honor is Yeshurun, is that which is straight, which is only to achieve its purpose in the straight way and is to oppose any crooked means of any purpose. So after that long introduction, in essence, what he is saying is, I'm going to explain this incident. I'm not doing it to be an apologist. I'm not doing it to make excuses. I'm going to explain it truthfully why what they did was right. And you're going to see there's going to be enough in this to justify why the sages see in this, why we suffered from it, particularly when we think that we are a people of Yeshurun, people who are straight, people who are the definition for the world of that which is the correct and straight and narrow. So when it happens to that people that you can find something which was crooked, we're going to pay the price. Even though you'll see, when I explain to you why this was done, it actually was the right course of action, and it has its negative consequence.
When have we ever made Esav suffer in comparison and balance to what they've made us suffer?
So maybe you know it's, you know the sages are saying that that's you know the actions of the forefathers. The Ramban writes, and we saw this years ago already when we studied the episode of Yishmael. So Sarah Imenu, Abraham's wife, kicks Hagar out of the house and does it in an unpleasant way. And the Ramban writes, all the centuries of pain and suffering that the Jewish people suffer at the hands of the Ishmaelim, the Arabs, is a result of that episode. So you want to talk about even, so here you have, you know, but it's Sarah. Sarah Imenu, and she causes pain to Hagar, and it's a trickle-down effect down to the generations. In God's scale, we measure things, you know, on our scale, we say, that doesn't seem fair. So God has a different scale that we don't, we only perceive the generation we're living in. So, you know, it's a different scale.
And even God tells Avram that Sarah was right, and listen to her. So it's not just Sarah who did the wrong thing. God said
so. So there were two episodes in which she caused her pain. But that's, you know, there are ramifications to her actions. The simplest example would be if you took, you know, we could do it, if you took a seed, an apple seed for a tree, and you went into the seed, and before you planted it, and you took a little knife, and you like, dug a hole into it, and you plucked out a little bit of this inner seed, and then you planted it, like, what impact would that have on the tree as a whole? So I don't know if anything, I don't know if we would take it in a human sense, in a strand of DNA, if you just did, you made a small little change in the DNA, so the human being that's created is, it just, there's a whole cast, but it started from such a small little thing, but that's how things go. You can, in the beginning of something, if you make a small deviation, so then as, you know, if you choose straight lines, and you move one off, in the beginning, as small as millimeter, and then as they go, right, hundreds of years later, thousands of years later, they're miles and miles and miles apart. Because the core, when you're building a root, is critical, and everything stems from that. So when you talk about the Avos and Sefer Bereishis and what happened, so these episodes and these incidents have long-lasting ramifications. Okay, let's get started. We got started. Says of our second paragraph on 441. Let us then try to get some understanding of the manner in which the three principal actors in this homely drama behave. So says of our, let's tackle it one at a time. That's the way I want to approach it. Let's take a look at how Yaakov behaves, at how Yitzchak, the father, behaves, and how the mother, Rivka, behaves. What does each character, what role do they play in this homely drama? Yaakov's behavior is completely clear and transparent. Yaakov himself, even though he's the one who steals the blessing, but his behavior is the easiest to justify and to explain, because what did he do? Right? That's what he did. He listened to Mommy. Mommy, who was Rivka Imenu, says, Yaakov, do this. Go here. Bring that. And he does. He goes out to get the flock. He remember, we saw the verses were very clear. Who dressed him? She did. The Torah was very clear. She was dressing him up in the goatskin. She was putting on Esav's clothes. She put the food in his hand and shoves him into the room. So until he's there, standing in front of his father, holding the food, he's not part of this. So says the first, right from the beginning, his mother appealed for his blind obedience to her orders. He said, but I'm going to get caught and cursed. And she said, it's on me. You do what I say. I accept upon myself your curses. She did not expect that he would do it to get an advantage for himself. It wasn't that she was telling him, you need this and do it for yourself. It was just, and quite expected that his whole character as an ish tam would revolt against it. Meaning, she knew. From his perspective, this was all wrong. I'm an ish tam. I am an isha emes. I'm a man of truth. A man of wholesomeness. This entire thing goes against the grain, and she knew it, and she was firm and demanding of, this is what must be done, you must follow my order. She therefore cuts all objections short by exercising her maternal authority and appealing to his duty to obey the orders of his mother. She takes full responsibility for anything that seems wrong and for all possible consequences of her plan. All he is to do is to obey. And we noted that as we went through the psukim, it was clear that way. She totally took over the whole thing. His role was to obey. She accepted upon herself responsibility for anything that might go wrong, any consequences that might come out of this. And his job was to follow her instructions. And so that, what Jacob did, was only, flipping over the page, top of page 442, was only out of obedience to his mother. And his behavior can only be blamed in as much as the duty of obedience of children too is limited by the laws of morality.
Yeah, what about that?
When one may not practice any deceit even out of obedience to one's mother.
Uh-huh.
So in looking at Yaakov, you say he listened to his mother. It went against his grain. It was repulsive to him that his mother pulled out all the cards and said, this is what you must do. And he listened. So if you were to measure and say what he did was wrong, the only element of wrong that you would have is, well, let's just take an extreme example. What if a mother would say, I hereby instruct you to, you know, go kidnap a child because I'm feeling lonely, I want to have another baby. So the son says, what do you mean? Mom says, I'm your mother, I told you to kidnap that child because I want to have another child. So then the son's obedience is to say, the laws of morality, that I can't do that, outweigh my obedience to you. So if you were to look at it from Yaakov's, that would be the only area where you would say there's what to talk about. His whole aspect here was listening to his mother. She was firm. She was with conviction as to what needs to be done. So if it was really, really wrong, so then he might have stood up and said, I think this is wrong. But even when and if you remember, his claim was, I'm going to get caught and cursed. He didn't say, this is wrong. He said, I'm going to be cursed. And she said, it's on me. So that, says the first, would be the one area where you might have said that maybe the paradigm of morality would have said goes against his mother. But otherwise, he was just simply obeying that which his mother demanded of him, which really makes then the principal character in this story, the mother, Rivka.
But why? Why was she so...
Excellent. That's his next paragraph. What Rav Hirsch has done with setting it up this way in terms of looking at the different characters is you really take Yaakov a little bit out of the picture by saying he was really listening to his mother. Maybe his sense of morality would have said, not, but here he does not go that route. So then the question really becomes exactly what you, I placed you right here to ask that question at the right perfect time. So that then shifts the question to her, why is she so adamant that this must be done? We asked the question in a little bit of a different way, which I'll reintroduce now to get us back into that. If you're Rivka, and you witness the scene that you just did, your husband Yitzchak says to your oldest son Esav, and he says, I'm getting old, I don't know when I'm going to die, I need to bless you. Go out to the field, I want to give you the blessings. Now you're Rivka. Now you've already, the boys are already, what did we come up with, 63? And they're in their 60s. You, Rivka, remember back when you were pregnant, carrying these twins after 20 years of barrenness and praying for children. You had a really difficult pregnancy. You went to the prophet at the time and he told you there are going to be two sons in your womb. One is going to be mightier than the other. Might will pass from one to the other. And that the younger one will be served by the older one. And you know that. You're holding on to that. And now you see, 60-some-odd years later, it's all gone wrong. And your husband, Yitzchak, who apparently she has never told this to, is about to bestow the blessing to his eldest son, Esav. What could you do at that time? The Rabban asked this question, remember. What would have been a better option?
Talk to him about
it. Yes, communicate. Go over to him and say, my dear husband Yitzchak, this is a grave mistake.
All along she could have been talking.
100%. So that was... So the Ramban addressed this question. The Ramban, if you recall, suggested a couple of answers that went along the lines of, she was either convinced he would either not believe her, or he would not give a blessing at all. Or that he would give a blessing, but it wouldn't be wholehearted anymore, because now he'd be thinking, I'm all confused, what's really going on, who's who I thought. She wanted the blessing to be given with full fervor, and the only way to do that was to allow him to continue this way, and come up with this plan. That's how the Ramban addressed this issue. But first he's going to address this issue here now also. Okay, what was she thinking, that this was the way that she went about stopping the blessing from being given? She has other tools available to her, and instead what she concocts is this plan which is fraught with danger, as her son Yaakov points out. I should dress up as my brother? How easy is it for me to get caught? Yitzchak himself says, Hakol kol Yaakov, v'hayadayim yidei Esav, the hands are the hands of Esav, but the voice is the voice of Yaakov. Yaakov, Yitzchak, the father, is suspicious the whole way through. Come here, let me feel you, your language doesn't fit. Why does she come up with such a plan instead of what would have been a more obvious, straightforward one, which he could have come up with? We'll see how Rav Hirsch is directly going to address this question. Let's go. Okay, says Rav Hirsch, what did Rebecca want? What was her thinking? What was her plan? What was her goal? The worst anti-Semites or anti-bibliologicalist will want to find some reasoning, some sense, or if you prefer it, some cunning in her action. I know, even imagine you're the most anti-Jewish person in the world. You're going to look and say to the story, what was she thinking? You're not just going to say she was evil. Even the most anti-Semitic biblical scholar will, at least in his own mind, ask this question that I'm asking. What was her goal? Why did she do this? This would be the kind of question I like to always borrow from Rabbi David Foreman. When you read a story in Chumash, and if you're sitting next to somebody, a non-Jew on the plane, and he says, you know, I was just reading the Bible, and I just came across the story of Jacob stealing the blessings, and the person would ask you the following question, saying, what was Rebecca thinking that she came up with this plan? If you can't answer that question, then you're missing the story. Those are what he calls like the big, obvious questions that we become so familiar with a story that we sometimes forget to ask this question of, why did she come up with such a dangerous, fraught with possibility of being caught? He's going to use the language, it's comical. You're going to dress up like your brother, you're going to put goat skin on your neck and on your arms, and think you're going to fool. This is child's play. What was she thinking? Says Rav Hirsch, yeah, the worse, the more artful such a person would like to make the Jewish ancestors appear, the less would that attribute to her the most complete imbecility, the most childish stupidity. How do we understand this goal? Like, we're so used to it, but really? This is what she came up with. What was her thinking? And even if her intention had been nothing more than, by her trickery, to manage to turn the paternal blessing on the head of her beloved Yaakov, now asks her first the most penetrating question. Let's say she succeeded. What do we believe about blessings? Do we believe that they have something to them? So the answer to that question, yes, because Avram gives bracha, so Yitzchak gives bracha. There's something to a bracha. Does a bracha work in a way in which it's like a blind arrow? My arrow is my blessing. I'm just going to fire it off. And wherever it lands, gets the blessing. Does it work like that? Because if I put a poison tip arrow and I'm in war, that's how it works. I don't need a target. I'm firing it out there against my enemy lines. And whoever it hits is the unfortunate recipient of my poison tipped arrow. That's how it works. I don't have to have you in mind. I don't have to know who you are. I don't ever have to see who gets it. I fire it off into enemy lines, and whoever it hits, too bad for them. Do blessings work that way? Do the divine blessings, the Abrahamic blessings, does Yitzchak just say, okay, I don't know who you are in front of me, and it doesn't really matter. Whoever it is will get it. Or is there some sense of, there's an intention between the one giving the blessing, the one receiving the blessing? Does God himself have a role in this? Does he have to agree as to who the one receiving the blessing is? So first she's now going to ask, and we'll see it in his poetic language. So she was thinking that I can fool my husband Yitzchak, and he's going to give the blessing to Yaakov. He's going to think he's giving it to Esav. Really, he's giving it to Yaakov, and it'll work just the same. Let's look at inside Refersh's language. Even if her intention had been nothing more than by her trickery to manage to turn the paternal blessing on the head of her beloved Yaakov, what possible thinkable result could she have expected from that? What everyone thinks her idea of the effect of a father's blessing might have been, whatever she thought the blessing was worth. In any case, she must have known that in this case, it must infallibly have resulted in the very opposite of her expectations. How could she think that Yitzchak is going to give the blessings to thinking it's one son and it be another son and it work just the same? Does she think the father's blessings is to call down happiness and success and prosperity on the head of the one who received it? Then how can she imagine, even if she succeeds in deceiving the old blind father, that God, the all-seeing one, could conceivably be taken in by such a pitiful mummery, or believe that the blessing of Avraham, which God had made conditional on tzedako mishpat, on righteousness and justice being practiced, could be obtained from that same God by way of such trickery and deception? Did she really think, A, that whoever Yitzchak blessed, whoever's head he landed on would work? And that even if it's true, that God would allow the blessing of Avraham, the bracha of tzedako mishpat, you are going to be the one to bring righteousness and justice to the world, should be bestowed upon one who through trickery and deception got the blessing of righteousness and justice? Did she think that made sense? But what, as the Ramban has stated explicitly, Yitzchak had every intention of giving the brachas to Esav. It was an intention to give him. It's unclear exactly if he takes it as far as making this. And many do make the distinction that you're making in terms of that. But let's take it as to Refersh's approach. And if what she was thinking of was some material benefit attached to this blessing, directly addressing your question, well, maybe you'll say he only was thinking about some material blessing, some legal preference in the ultimate heritage dependent on being thus recognized as the firstborn, that all the blessing contained was who gets the legal rights of double or some other first rights of being the firstborn. How can such an advantage fail to become utterly void as a mekach tos, a transaction obtained under false impression? The discovery of the deception was unavoidable. So even if you say it's only material, if it had some more religious connotations, how could it be that the blessing is just like an arrow that it just hits whatever target? And how could God bestow any spiritual blessings that are based on tzedakah u'mishpat, on righteousness and justice, on someone who gets it through deception and trickery? And even if you say it only was material, as some would learn, she was going to be caught. as Esav, of course, finds out literally 2 minutes later. So how can the blessing, any material benefit, there's a basic principle in all of Jewish law called mekach tos. It's a faulty purchase. If you sell me something under false pretenses, the item is not what you said it was, the deal is null and void. It's a basic tenet of Jewish business law. So even if he's only giving material blessings, the whole thing is voided.
But Isaac says, I can't take it back. And you can't. I can't give you now because
so how,
I gave it to your brother. So he says it's...
So, what was she thinking that could be? How could she's saying she has to have known that it can't possibly work. And then what does it mean that Yitzchak... Then we'll have to get to that. Why should that be that Yitzchak says it's too late? Continues Rav Hirsch, even if the carrying out of the masquerade were to be successful, says Rav Hirsch, with Esav's return, everything was inevitably bound to be disclosed. So even if she got through the whole episode, which she does, but as happens, the whole thing is going to be uncovered. So how does this work? Rebecca must have known this full well. You know, sometimes you run into you make this whole long plan, like in the movies or books, or right, someone makes this elaborate plan, and they pull it off, and then they're well, now what? We accomplished what we set out to do, but how are we now not going to be traced and caught? So okay, she got this whole great plan. She got the two kids, the two goats. She had them slaughtered, prepared. She dresses Yaakov up. She gets him in there. He gets the buzz, aha, Esav's coming. Wasn't that obvious that Esav wasn't going to come? And this whole thing, of course, as soon as Esav walks in, it's going to become clear that the first child who was there was Yaakov, and the whole thing was a scam. Didn't she? She had to have known that. And altogether, how crude was the whole comedy? A couple of goat skins. What but the most absolute naivety could be taken in by that? What could her intention have been by playing such a comedy? Says Rav Hirsch, it's hard to fathom. A couple of goat skins? You're going to fool Yitzchak with goat skins? It's a comedy, says Rav Hirsch.
Even the food she made must have tasted different than the game would have been.
Right, it's close, but it's not the same. Says Rav Hirsch, listen to this approach. What else but just the comedy itself? That, I believe, says Rav Hirsch, was her goal, to make a comedy of this. Listen to how he says this. Only thus, if just the inevitable discovery was what was beforehand reckoned on, meaning that she planned this whole thing in order to be discovered, only then does the whole story make sense. And from Rebecca's point of view, become understandable, and even if not completely approved of, in the circumstances, quite excusable. Now he's going to explain. Let me just say what he said so far. Her plan was to get caught. My plan is to come up with a plan that will inevitably lead to discovery. And when you look at it like that, you say, oh, that's what she was thinking. Now I can understand her intentions. In Refersh's language, even if not completely approved of, because we're going to see the sages, we suffer from this. So even if it's not completely approved of, it is, at least in the circumstances, quite excusable that she went ahead with this plan in order to get caught.
Yes.
Right? We need to keep reading because we need to see what he means by that.
Yes. Well, to make Esav realize now.
Make Yitzchak. Continues the verse. As an introduction to this procedure, as an introduction, meaning the verses that introduce this episode, if you remember the beginning of this chapter, it's right, you don't have it in front of you because it's the previous verse of the previous chapter. The Torah, you do have it, it's on page 440. On page 4, if you flip back a page. On page 440, the Torah says in verses 34 and 35, which are the immediate preceding verses, and Esav was 40 years old when he took the wife, to a wife, Yehudith, Bas Be'eri Hachiti. Yes, Basmas Bas Elon Hachiti. He takes for himself two Chitite women as wives, and they were a source of mental opposition or anguish to Yitzchok and to Rivka. That's the introduction to our story. We mentioned when we learned this that Rashi already points out that Yitzchak, Esav tried to fool his father already. He waited till he was 40, which was the same age that his father Yitzchak had waited to get married, but he marries women that he knew his parents were not happy wife. The Hittite women were not what they were looking for. They would always specifically leave that area to find wives for their children, for, as Avram did, Yitzhak later will do. And that's the introduction to our story. So first point out, as an introduction to this procedure, we were given the information how Esav, of his own accord, gave the great Abrahamic mission a double knockout blow by marrying two Hittite women. If anything could have opened Yitzchak's eyes to the complete unworthiness of his elder son, surely this would have done it.
Well,
I'm sorry. I'm going to keep reading.
Married these people. The parents didn't know he was going to marry them.
He did. So, if anything should have made him aware, I'm now back to the bottom of page 442. On the bottom of 442, if anything could have made Yitzchak aware that of the complete unworthiness of his elder son, as the Torah has already stated, his elder son Esav has been trying his best to fool his father about him his entire life. Everybody have Ram? So, if anything should have clued him. I'm in the very last line of 442, top line of 443. This should have done it. Nevertheless, immediately following Esav's marrying the two Hittite women, did I lose everybody on the flipping of the pages?
No,
look for the page numbers. 442, the very bottom of 442.
The top of
443.
Now I'm at the top of 443.
We don't have 443.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah,
you do.
Where, oh, I see. Okay.
It's not me.
Okay, second sentence there. Nevertheless, we see Isaac Yitzchak calling his elder son to be blessed by him, meaning immediately after he marries the two women, the next thing the Torah tells us is that Yitzchak says, I'm going to die. I'd like to give a blessing to you, my eldest son, to make him the future guide and leader of the house of Abraham. You are going to be the future guide. You are going to be the leader. You're going to take your place as the eldest son, which we've seen over and over again. The eldest had a certain stature and a position, which is what some learned that Esav had sold to Yaakov. But Yitzchak is unaware of that as well. And now he's about to install his son Esav as the head of the household of the Abrahamic mission. So it says, refers, what a hunter with his mouth Esav must have been.
Yes.
Well,
I'm
sure that,
to you.
I'm sorry.
What a hunter with his mouth he must have been. So here you have Esav, who has been referred to already as a hunter with his mouth. And now how much he has fooled his father, Yitzchak, that now after marrying these women, who the Torah describes as causing nothing but anguish to his parents, and now his father still says, but I want to install you as the leader of the house of Avraham. How he must have known how to dissemble and feign, in spite of his completely un-Abrahamitic life, to ensnare the heart of his father and deceive him. That's what we are set up with. And to that, Rivka says, how am I now to tell Yitzchak that he's making a mistake? So we said, well, first option would have been to talk to him. Go in and say, he's been fooling you. Well, says Rav Hirsch, how successful did she think she would be in that conversation?
Very much. No communication beforehand.
She would not accomplish it, because if Esav has done such a job until now to convince his father that he should take that place as head of the household, with all that he's been doing over the last decades, and Yitzchak still thinks he should be in that position, it's highly unlikely that Rivka will be able to talk him out of it. So says Rav Hirsch, but she had a different plan. You know what that plan was? She was going to show him how easily fooled he could have been. She's going to show him, I'm going to show you that Yaakov can pretend to be Esav. And if I can do it with goatskins and a meal from my flock, and have you think that Esav is really Yaakov, or that Yaakov in this case is really Esav, then don't you think it's also possible that Esav can be convincing you that he's a Yaakov and he's not? So it was the essence of getting caught. It was, her goal was to pull it off, and then immediately have Yitzchak say, oh, 2 minutes later when Esav walks in, wait a minute, what just happened here? So Rivka can say, Yaakov just pretended he was Esav. And with goat skins and a meal, He did it. Don't you think Esav can do it too? And it was, in essence, to get caught, that was her entire plan. It was the comedy of the goatskins. It was, she knew she would be caught. And she wanted it, and she needed it, because the message she needed to communicate to her husband was, Esav's been fooling you. He's an expert. He's the best there is. But she can't just tell that to him, because Yitzchak's going to say, nah, it's impossible. How could I be fooled like that? I know my son. So the way that she communicated it was by showing him Yaakov can do it too.
Smart lady.
Isn't that a brilliant approach?
It puts a different light on their relationship.
It does. So there's a lot of talk here about the relationship, but it's interesting. That's the approach of Hirsch is going to take. As in his language, what the most absolute naivety would be taken, what kind of comedy, what was her intention? Her intention was to get caught. But her intention was to show these two boys are alike enough that with just a little manipulation, you could be completely fooled as to who is who.
That's why he trembled when he found out.
And when he trembled when he found out, that's what the sages say. All of a sudden he realized, indeed, Esav had been fooling him.
Yeah.
Let's read inside a little bit more so we can get to still a few more minutes today. In the little word, na, hine na zakanti. This is in the introduction that Yitzchak says to his son. He says, I'm getting old. Please bring me food. So in that word, na, see after all that I'm already old. It is made clear that he had already long had the intention to bestow such a blessing, but had been dissuaded, had yielded to remonstration. So Rafershna wants to learn that I'm now old, meaning I've always wanted to do this. Now this is how Rafershna is going to learn this differently than what we've been suggesting. I've always wanted to do this, but I've been dissuaded until now from doing it. Rebecca had probably constantly argued with him, trying to convince him of the truth, and had then persuaded him, anyway, leave it for a time. You are not so old yet. There is still plenty of time. And had hoped in the meantime that he would be undeceived, but she had not succeeded. Her first is learning. Again, this is not the way that we've been saying that they never spoke about it, that she never told him. She did tell him, she's been working on him. But the bottom line is, Yitzchak has been fooled. And all of the evidence that he has points to a righteous son. And she keeps saying, he's not, I'm telling you, you don't understand him. So she says, oh, you know, wait, you're not old enough yet, wait. Hoping and hoping that eventually something will, Esav will slip. Something will happen that will make it clear to him. But, didn't work.
So he didn't trust his wife either then.
And now, because his evidence went the other way. His evidence said, he's a righteous son, he's my oldest. My oldest is supposed to take over. And now, what was she to do? What could she have wanted with this plan? Nothing but to bring home to him, to convince him at Hamanin, that and how easily he could be deceived. Mm-hmm. I need to prove to you that it's possible. I've been trying to convince you, keep saying, it's not possible. It's not possible. All my evidence points to the fact that he's a righteous child and he should take his place as the firstborn. So her goal was to show him you can be deceived. It's possible. And if a Yaakov, who's an Ishtam, if our wholesome son, our tzaddik, our son who's sitting in the base medrash learning, if he can do it, don't you think Esav, our man of the fields, our hunter, our man of the world, don't you think he can do it too? Even a Yaakov did it to you.
I was told once that Yitzchak wanted someone who was more dynamic. You know, because Yaakov sat in the tents all day, he didn't go out, and he thought that he needed Esav to spread religion, because he was out there, charismatic, infecting people. And so he thought that Esav should get it, because he needed to be the...
We learned, one of the approaches that we had studied was the approach that Maharaj Shiva had expressed, I'm pretty sure we did this together, in which there's a what he calls the Avodah Schutz, the outside work and the inside work. There's the Rosh Hashiva and there's the executive director. And so he said, you needed both. And so Yitzchak always assumed they would both be there together. Yitzchak's role, Esav's role, excuse me, would be more on the outside. And it was important and critical. And Yaakov would be on the inside. But Esav really wasn't interested in that. But anyway, let's finish up this argument. If a Yaakov, an Ishtam, can so easily masquerade as a Gibor Tzad, if it's easy for this wholesome man to masquerade as a hunter, how much more easily can an Esav, who is a hunter, masquerade as an Ishtam, as a simple, wholesome man? And in this, Yitzchak's undeception through Yaakov's deception. Right, look at that poetic phrase. Rivka succeeded perfectly. She had every intention of getting caught. She had every intention of this whole masquerade being uncovered as soon as Yaakov exited stage left. As soon as Yitzchak realized the trick that had been played upon him, the Torah described a tremendous trembling that he trembled, a terrific shock he received, because he saw, as the sages put it, Gehenim yawning at his very feet. He saw how all his life he had allowed himself to be deceived. Immediately the scales fell from his eyes, and he immediately added deliberately his confirmatory and now fully consciously expressed blessing, Gam Baruch Yihyeh, indeed he shall be blessed. Here we now see, we said, but he said it worked, I can't take it back. That's what he meant when he said, Gam Baruch Yihyeh. He put a stamp on it afterwards and he said, I gave that blessing and it should be. It should be fulfilled. Maybe when I gave it, you have this element of, but the divine blessing was put, given to the wrong person. But then when Esav says, but what about me? Yitzchak says, I gave it to him, v'gam baruch yi, and indeed he'll be blessed, because now I see indeed that which, as Rav Hirsch has been learning, my wife's been telling me this whole time, you're not who you said you were, and now I have proof. My son Yaakov convinced me that he was you. Certainly you can convince me that you were him. And if my son Yaakov went ahead and did this, it must be because, indeed, you are not deserving of this blessing. And Gam Baruch, yeah, I see the gates of Gehenna open in front of me. My son Yaakov would do such a thing like this. It must be that you are indeed not deserving of this blessing. And the blessing should indeed be taken. Okay, we have a little bit more on this. We'll finish that Mirat Hashem next week. Have a wonderful afternoon.
It's really exciting. Oh, wow. I like that a lot.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.